Stem cell science is changing medicine and our understanding of human development. Learn more with the Stem Cell Channel. Visit uctv.tv/stemcell.
Thank you so much. It's a real pleasure for me to be here today. And today I'm going to tell you about the work of my lab in improving modeling of human brain development and disease. And I'd like to start by showing you this beautiful image. So this is a painting from a friend of mine, Jude Papaloco. He has a gallery in Miami. And so the first time I saw this painting, it actually really reminded me of this quote by Santiago Ramón y Cajal that says, "As long as our brain is a mystery, the universe, the reflection of the structure of the brain, will also be a mystery." And this is even more true if we think about people affected by neuropsychiatric disorders. Their experience of the reality is actually different from the experience of a neurotypical person, and this indeed reflects changes in the function and structure of their brain. We know that neuropsychiatric disorders are a huge burden for our society. However, in the last 70 years or so, we haven't really been able to come up with effective treatment for these disorders. This is due to many reasons. To me, one of the most important is really the incredibly complex genetic of these disorders. So for example, if we think about autism spectrum disorders, most subtypes of autism are polygenic, which means the same variant in the same genes, but in two different individuals, will actually lead to completely different clinical manifestation. So this really calls for the use of human tissue for understanding better these disorders. And obviously, while we cannot access the human brain, the living human brain, as it should be, brain organoids derived from pluripotent stem cells are really open a window into aspects of human brain development and disorder that we haven't been able to really model before. And now I want to give you an overview about the field of brain organoids over the past decade or so. This is actually a bit of an outdated review right now. But yeah, I really want to highlight that the first landmark paper showing really the incredible potential of human pluripotent stem cells to self-organize into 3D structures. It came from the Sasai laboratory in 2008. And here you can see they were able to show the human embryonic stem cells are able to generate this layer structure. And you can see here the formation of this ventricle-like structure, so empty cavity that is fluid-filled, much like the ventricles in our brain. And then you can see progenitors surrounding these ventricles and then neurons layered on the top of these progenitors. So this was in 2008. And then in 2013, we also see there were two other very important landmark papers published. One from the Jürgen Knoblich lab by Madeleine Lancaster, was a postdoc at the time in his lab, and then by Kadoshima. This is another paper from the Sasai lab. And so basically in this review, we highlighted in blue these all the protocols, organoids protocol, that rely on self-patterning property. So we do not use morphogen to differentiate these organoids. They just rely on the self-patterning ability. And so Madeleine was able to show that with this protocol, in these aggregates, there is co-development of different brain regions. Instead, this protocol from Kadoshima et al., they use morphogens to direct the differentiation of this aggregate into the cortical territory. So this was the first protocol for generation of cortical organoids. And then we have seen the establishment of many other protocols that mostly rely on morphogens to direct the differentiation into different brain regions. And then we also have in green, we highlight how also the interest of the field in trying to integrate other cell type into these organoids, like, for example, endothelial cells of microglial cells. These are non-ectodermal derivatives, but it's very important to integrate these cell types and integrate them functionally to have organoids that are more and more physiological. And so going back to 2017, this is when I was basically still a postdoctoral fellow in Paola Lotta lab, and we decided to build on the beautiful work of Madeleine Lancaster that, as I mentioned before, it relies on self-patterning of brain organoids. And at the time, organoids were cultured for only about 1, maximum 2 months. But we really wanted to extend that time in culture of these organoids, and we managed to do so. So in this paper, we characterized very thoroughly organoids that were up to 9 months old, but now we know that they can actually survive much longer in culture. When I was postdoc in Palace Lab, I started some culture, and then they were able to keep them going for like, I think 6 or 7 years. And then at some point they just stopped them because there was really no point. And I think they are trying to characterize them. But just to tell you that, you know, we really can keep these organoids alive and healthy for a very long time. Now, reaching this milestone of keeping organoids alive for a long time, we could ask several questions, several important questions. One was, what is the actual cellular composition of the organoids? What are the cell types that are missing? What's the maturation stage that they reach? And are the neurons functional in this culture? And so to address the first question, we actually were very lucky because at the time, Steve McCarroll and Eva McCosker, that are the inventor of the droplet sequencing, they were our neighbor. And so we could, before they published their work, use droplet sequencing to do the first large-scale single-cell sequencing of organoids. And so we were able to understand the cellular composition of these organoids for the first time. Here, this is really data on one specific cell lines. We now know that different cell lines, especially with self-patterning protocols, will yield different type of results. But at least for this line, which is a iPS line, we saw that actually organoids generate also not only ectodermal derivatives, but also mesodermal cells. We know most of this line will also generate endodermal progenitors. So it was really not at all, you know, they don't make only brain cells at all. And we also wanted to look into the organoid-to-organoid reproducibility in cell type composition. And so here you can see in this TCNA plot, we plotted 19 organoids, each one with a different color. And you can see how different the cellular composition is in each individual organoid. This obviously, you know, is not a very good news for disease modeling. We do not want to put ourselves in a condition in which there is so much heterogeneity if we want to understand disease phenotype. But at the time, we still decided to, you know, focus on this for brain generation, for brain cells, to really study at higher resolution what the cell types generating these organoids were. And so the organoids that actually do make for brain cells, they are able to generate all the main cell type of the fetal human cortex. And we did this by crossing this dataset with single cell dataset from fetal human brain from Arnold Krigsten lab. And as I said, especially all the cells from the dorsal forebrain were present. We know there is more variability in generation of ventral forebrain. But and then what we also wanted to look at was the structural and functional features of these organoids. And we were able to do EM reconstruction. We were able to see these neurons in culture achieve a very high degree of maturation. You can see here they are able to generate the dendritic spines. We know that instead neurons differentiated in 2D, they have this very small protrusion and don't develop very well in functional spines. Instead, in 3D, spines are generated, as you can see here. And so this is a reconstruction in an organoid that is 8 months old. And then you can see also that we did also look at network activity, and we found that organoids develop network activity, and over time, there is an increase in the level of activity. So these organoids stay healthy and they keep on maturing. We also, I show you, I don't know if you noticed, but in the TCNA plot that I show you at the beginning, we also found that some of these organoids make also retinal cells. And when we look at the retinal cells that are made, these organoids are able to make all the main cell types that are present in the endogenous retina, including photoreceptors. When we look at the profile of these photoreceptors, they really seem equipped with the molecular machinery to be photosensitive. And sure enough, when we shine light of these organoids, we were able to see a change in the pattern of neural activity. This was pretty exciting. So now we know that organoids, retinal organoids, are photosensitive. Back then, we didn't have this evidence. But for us, it was pretty exciting because we thought now, you know, we are able to study not only network activity, but also network reactivity. So we can see how organoids react to physiological stimulation. And the other interesting point for us was that we know that during the development of the human brain, sensory stimulation is very important for maturation of circuits. And so we thought that this could be an entry point for maturation of organoids that we know still retain embryonic-like features. So this is one of the biggest issues and limitation of organoids. They do mature to a certain extent, but then they stop. And so there is something missing, which probably is cell types, but also level of activity, sensory input, of course, are missing in this culture. And so we were very excited about this. But as I told you, these organoids, especially these self-patterning organoids, are very variable. And so the reality is that we had also organoids, we have organoids with this protocol that do not have retinal cells at all. And so to take advantage of this photosensitivity, we JP Urenda, that is a really talented PhD candidate in my lab, he thought about designing a project, which is a very blue sky and difficult project. And I'm going to tell you about it just because I think it's an interesting approach, but we have very preliminary data on this. But anyway, the goal of this project was to use patterned organoids from retinal, thalamic, and cortical organoids and to culture them into a device. And the idea was that, you know, after patterning them, for sure we will get the cell types we want and the type of organoids we want. So reproducibility, higher reproducibility, of course, in compared to these self-patterning organoids. But we wanted to avoid to fuse. So we know that now co-culture of organoids from different brain regions are actually generated by fusing organoids in these so-called assembloids. But we wanted to keep, what we really want to do is to keep these organoids separated so that they can keep their anatomy. And this is, we think, very important because if we want to establish reproducible and functional long-range connectivity, we really need to keep the anatomical organization of each organoid. And the idea is that then we can use this photosensitivity to boost activity-dependent maturation. And the reason why we really care about having organoids that retain their anatomical features and then the possibility to really guide connectivity between organoids is that we know that many of these neurodevelopmental disorders are actually connectopathy. So we see when we do functional imaging of patients with these disorders, we see that there are issues in the way long-range tract of axons really in the macro connectivity in this patient. And so we want to, I think it's very important in general as a direction, as in the field, to try to establish model of these connectopathies. And so normally, as I mentioned, now the state of the art to study interaction between different brain regions and connectivity between these regions are these assembloids. However, there is also a recent paper from this year that shows that when you culture organoids and you keep them, like you don't fuse them, but you connect them, keeping them separated, the level of activity is more intense and also the oscillatory behavior is more complex. So in this paper they did do this, so they kept organoids separated and look at the level of activity. There are other papers in which they did the same, so they were able to culture organoids in hydrogels and then achieve connectivity and formation of this axon fascicle. But the problem with this approach is that these organoids are kept in static culture. So we know that to be healthy, organoids need to be cultured in dynamic condition. State of the art are these bioreactors, or we can also use a shaker to keep the medium moving. If we culture organoids in static condition for a very long time, they will suffer. All right, so to summarize this first part of my talk, today I show you that brain organoids can be developed for a very long time. Self-patterning organoids are really lead to very heterogeneous cellular composition. And then I show you that organoids over time, they do not only survive, but they mature and they develop network activity. These networks can be modulated by sensory stimulation from light-sensitive cells. And then I think one key message I also want to give you is that integration of tissue and bioengineering approaches, I think, is very important for the progress of this field. So if we want to at some point really reach, increase the physiological relevance of organoids, we need to integrate these approaches in our designs. And yeah, so now I want to switch gear and tell you a bit more about the effort of my lab in neuropsychiatric disease modeling. The protocol that we are using in the lab to generate cortical organoids is the one published by Kadoshima et al. In 2013, and then this has been characterized as modified by the Arlotta lab and published in 2019 by Silvia Velasco. And the Arlotta lab has shown that this protocol is very highly reproducible across multiple lines. And obviously, so this is a very important, as Lilia mentioned, conditions of reproducibility is very important if we want to understand disease phenotype. And so we think with this protocol, we are in good shape. And we are specifically in my lab interested in understanding the function of SYNGAP1. This is one of the top ASD risk gene. And the novel pathogenic variants of SYNGAP1 lead to intellectual disability, epilepsy, and global developmental delay. So what do we know about SYNGAP1? So most of what we know about SYNGAP1 has been described in mouse neurons, and where SYNGAP has been shown to be a synaptic protein with different domains. So this is a very complex protein. There is a RasGAP domain that is an enzymatic domain that is important for synaptic transmission. And then there is the PSD domain that is very important for the scaffolding function of SYNGAP1, so to hold in place different members of the postsynaptic density of the neurons. So when the expression of SYNGAP1 is decreased in this neuron, there are issues in basically synaptic transmission. There have been many laboratories that have worked on this. When Marcella Birter, postdoctoral fellow in the lab, and Ashley Del Dosso joined the lab, they were very, very much interested in understanding the function of SYNGAP in human neurons, and specifically in subtype of human neurons, since this information was missing. I must say that Ashley graduated recently, and Marcella, she's almost ready to be on the job market. She's incredibly talented. And anyway, when they joined the lab, so the first thing they did was start looking into single cell sequencing data set. They wanted to see if SYNGAP was expressed differentially in different subtype of cortical neurons. And they were surprised to see that in addition to being expressed in neurons, SYNGAP was also expressed in progenitor cells. So this was surprising, and we were not expecting that, but also, you know, single cell sequencing, of course, RNA single cell sequencing just tell us about RNA expression, which may not mean much. And so what we did next was to look at expression of the protein. Initially, we did a staining for SYNGAP1 in organoids. Here you see this is a section of a cortical organoid. You can see the SYNGAP1 is basically expressed here at the apical end feet of the radial glial cells. The pattern of expression is very similar, you can see, to TJP1, also known as ZO1, that is expressed also at the apical end feet of radial glial cells. Obviously, TJP1 is not expressed in neuron while SYNGAP1 is, but there is this, you know, overlap. And so this was very interesting, and we also wanted to confirm this with proteomics. So we took organoids at day 7. At day 7, organoids generated with the Kadoshima protocol, they are mostly composed only of ventricular radial glia, and we indeed found that SYNGAP was there. We found, now we're doing a more thorough work in trying to characterize which isoforms are expressed there, but we did find definitely the alpha 1, which is also the isoform that in neurons is important for DEF scaffolding because it contains this PSD domain. And we did see SYNGAP, and we also look at interactor of SYNGAP1, and we, for example, validated TJP1 as an interactor of SYNGAP1 in ventricular progenitors. Well, this is also, we also wanted to validate this in vivo. So you can see that expression of SYNGAP and TJP1 is similar also in suction from human fetal brain. And so at this point, we were pretty convinced that SYNGAP is actually present in progenitors. And we wanted to understand what is it doing there. So we did do bulk sequencing from organoids from a patient that carries a variant that leads to SYNGAP1 haploinsufficiency. And we compare it with organoids that are in which we did correction of this variant. And the terms that came up were all related to cytoskeleton remodeling, cell adhesion, and terms of this type. And then we also did an analysis on the interactor of SYNGAP1, and basically very similar terms came up. So it seemed like SYNGAP has something to do with cytoskeleton remodeling. We know that ventricular radial glia are very special cells, so they have these two processes. One is a basal process and one is an apical process. And the apical process, the contact with the ventricle through the apical process is very important for controlling the self-renewal towards basically the proliferation of these cells. Instead, the basal process that reaches the PL surface is important for the generation of the cortical layers because newborn neurons walk on this process. And so disruption of extension and cytoskeleton remodeling for these processes obviously can be very problematic. We, at the beginning, we wanted to really look at the dynamic of extension of these processes. So we team up with Randy Ashton at University of Wisconsin-Madison. Randy has developed this very nice 2.5D single ROSAT assay. And in this assay, because there is just one ventricle, you can really look at the polarity of these radial glial cells. And we found that in organoids with haploinsufficiency, with SYNGAP haploinsufficiency, there were some that didn't make this ventricle at all. And the ones that made it had, had a weird type of shape and circularity, or also the diameter, the perimeter was basically impaired. This is just a movie of this generation of this ventricle in culture. So you can see in the control, there is a stratification and the polarity of the radial glia is more evident here. This is one of these rosettes that actually makes the ventricle, but you can see that overall, the rosette is much more disorganized. We also were able to confirm this phenotype in another line that generated by the COBA lab at USC. And this line is a RAS-gap dead. So it's basically the enzymatic domain of SYNGAP1 is non-functional. So this is a full knockout for the enzymatic function of SYNGAP. And what we found is that the phenotype was even more, you know, strong because this is a full knockout, not haploinsufficiency. And so you can see that basically these organoids with these RAS-gap dead organoids weren't able to generate these ventricles at all. So now we really like organoids, so we wanted to see what's the phenotype, what SYNGAP1 haploinsufficiency does to organoids, and we found that normally in control organoids we can see a very clear separation between the germinal zone, the progenitor zone, and then the cortical cells. We do not see layers, but you know, we in these protocols, but we do see this separation. And then you can see that in this haploinsufficient organoid, actually there was a lot of disorganization, and then you can see neurons that were actually, I don't know, either migrating into the progenitor zone or were stuck there. So anyway, it was completely disorganized. We also look at the division angle of radial glial cells in organoids, and we saw that there is a switch towards differentiative division. This was also, we also wanted to confirm this with single cell sequencing. And so you can see that there is a decrease in the number of apical radial glia in organoids that are 4 months old. And then if you look at the, you know, just terms downregulated in the apical radioglia, these are like related to mitosis and cell cycle proliferation. And then there is upregulation instead of terms related to the differentiation. So it seems like seeing a apical insufficiency really alters the proliferation dynamics, supranuclear dynamics of this ventricular radial glia. We also wanted to see if this is something that happens also in vivo. So we did team up with Gavin Rumbaugh. So Gavin is at Scripps in Florida. And Gavin very kindly shared with us these SYNGAP mutant mice. And so we characterized heterozygous and knockout mice. And we found that, again, very similar to what we see in organoids, we see decrease in proliferation, increase in differentiation of these progenitor cells. I also have to say that there is a paper was published a few years ago by the State Lab at UCSF. They did downregulation of SYNGAP1 in Xenopus, and what they saw was a decrease in the size of the Xenopus telencephalon, but they also saw this imbalance between progenitors and neurons generation. So this really seems like something, a function of SYNGAP that is really conserved across species. And going back to the organoids, we also wanted to see if this precocious differentiation of the radial glia would also lead to accelerated maturation. And so we look at structural and functional features of neurons in this culture, and we found that indeed there is an increase in dendritic complexity of neurons in these haploinsufficient organoids, and there is also an increase in activity. Again, suggested that SYNGAP haploinsufficiency leads to accelerated maturation of cortical projection neurons. So to summarize this second part of my talk, so today I show you that we were able with this study to uncover a function of SYNGAP1 in radial glial progenitors. So when there is SYNGAP1 in haploinsufficiency, SYNGAP1 haploinsufficiency leads basically to disruption of the organization of the cortical plate and to accelerated maturation of cortical projection. So these data, I think, are very important because they really tell us that instead of relying on GOT terms category when we think about gene associated to neurodevelopmental disorders, we really need to look beyond that and really try to understand the function of these genes in specific cell types and different developmental stages, because many of these so-called synaptic proteins, they could be doing something completely different in other cell types. Indeed, we have found also that SYNGAP1 is not the only synaptic protein expressed in progenitors. There are actually other members of the synaptic proteins that are important for the postsynaptic, for holding in place postsynaptic density neurons that are already expressed in progenitors. So one project that we have, and we are very interesting, so we are very interested in testing the hypothesis that perhaps the complex that is important, some members of the complex that is important to maintain the scaffolding of neurons are also important to maintain the scaffolding of radial glial cells. And they may represent a point of convergence for neurodevelopmental disorders. So this is something that, you know, we are interested in testing. And this is actually artwork by Jane Quackley, that is a local artist in Los Angeles. And so Jane, she made these two sculptures, this sculpture of a neuron and the radial glia. And so she wanted to represent this idea that perhaps some of the complex that are important for, you know, scaffolding of in the neurons are recycled in radial glial cells. And so, yeah, we're doing more work on this. The reality is that many of these organoids that are non-cortical, supposedly, so they are thalamic or cerebellar or others, they will still make cortex. So we have a reporter line, a couple of reporter lines in the lab that report for cortical territory, so for FOXG1, for example. And we see that many of these protocols, you know, we still make part of the cortex, because, you know, it's hard to pattern them and caudalize them. So we really wanted to focus on generating a strong and robust protocol for generation of cerebellar organoids. And why the cerebellum? Well, the cerebellum is a very interesting brain region. It contains most of the neurons of the human brain, so up to 80% of our neurons are actually in the cerebellum. And also when we look at the development of the cerebellum, is really quite protracted in most mammals. And then also from an evolutionary point of view, the cerebellum is actually the structure that has evolved the most, even more than the cerebral cortex that always outshines the cerebellum. And this, we see that the cerebellum is rapidly expanded in the great ape clade, really suggesting that it may be responsible for the acquisition of some human-specific traits, even though we don't often think about the cerebellum in these terms. And now there are more and more evidence that also link cerebellum to neuropsychiatric disorder as well. So this is a very unexplored area, but I think very, very important. And we'll, I think in the future we'll see more and more work that geared towards understanding what's the contribution of cerebellum to these neuropsychiatric disorders. And so Alexandra Tamian, that is an extremely talented PhD candidate in the lab. Actually, Alex just is about to graduate. So next, we have his PhD defense next week. And so he will be on the job market for a postdoc. So, you know, let me know if you are interested in hiring a super talented postdoc. But so Alex was able to develop this very strong patterning strategy for generation of the ischemic organizer, that is a region from which the cerebellum arises. And he built this mostly all work on previous work from Mary Atten's lab. They were able to found what the cocktail of morphogen that is important for specification of Purkinje neurons in 2D in vitro. And so we really learn a lot from this work from Mary Atten, and then we tweak it to generate the whole cerebellum. And so this is a single cell analysis of this cerebellar organoid. So you can see that we were able to generate all the main cell type of the cerebellum, including Purkinje neurons that are very, so when we look at their transcription profile, they really express all the markers that really define Purkinje neurons in vivo, so bona fide Purkinje neurons, and also progenitors of the rhombic leap. A few years ago, Katie Millen has described these human-specific progenitors of the rhombic leap in the cerebellum, and recently has been shown association between these progenitors and the origin of medulloblastoma. So we think that, you know, this is a very powerful to have these cells in culture, because it can really be helpful for the study of medulloblastoma. We also found that expression of generation cells of the choroid plexus, which we think also contributes to keeping these organoids very healthy. We look at the reproducibility of these organoids, and we found that they are really reproducible, which is of course good news for disease modeling. And then we look at the structure of these organoids. And normally, during cerebellar development, there is a distinction between the Purkinje layers of neurons and the granule cell layers, so they are distincted. But you can see that when we look at BORO1 and SCORE2 expression in our organoids, they were sort of intermingled. And then Alex was able to discover that prolonged administration of SDF1 is actually able to help in the site architecture of these organoids. So you can see that now we can see a separation between the Purkinje layers and the granule layers. And normally SDF1 is a chemokine that binds, it's very important for the migration of granule cells and for their differentiation. And so we think that basically this is important for the migration of granule cells in the outer part of the organoid. And I must say also that, so we have done this treatment for only 30 days. I'm not sure whether continuing the treatment will help, but basically we see that in organs that are 3 months old, the layering crumbles. So I just want to disclose that this is something that is a transitory layering. We don't see it forever, but perhaps, and we have really to do that experiment. It's very expensive, but we should do it. Like perhaps, I don't know, addition of SDF for a prolonged amount of time could help with keeping the structure, but I'm not sure. Anyway, even just having this structure there for a while. I think it's important because we know that activity emerges already by the time organoids are 2 months old. We see a lot of activity. And so having, you know, this sort of more stereotypical positioning of neurons in organoids, I think can help with the reproducibility and also establishment of right connectivity. And so here you can see indeed that in 2 months old in culture, organoids are very active, and we see contribution of both inhibitory and excitatory neuron in culture. Over time, these organoids keep on maturing, and we see increasing coordinated activity in 6 month old cerebellar organoids. We have also done, in collaboration with Carlos Lois at Caltech, we have done an experiment in which we have inhibited the activity of the Purkinje neurons. So L7 is a promoter that is specific for Purkinje neurons. And so we have seen that if we inhibit Purkinje neurons in culture, there is overall an increase in the activity. And Purkinje neurons are inhibitory cells, so this tells us that Purkinje cells really actively contributed to nectar function in vitro. We also did patch clamping, and this is work by Marcella Birtele. Marcella did patch clamping of Purkinje neurons. And what she saw is that indeed these cells, they are able to, she was able to induce an action potential. She saw this induced action potential. She also see spontaneous action potential. And what it was very exciting for us is that she was able to find this specific pattern of activity that is a spontaneous repetitive firing that is very specific of Purkinje neurons in vivo. Really suggesting that these Purkinje neurons really develop in bona fide Purkinje neurons in vitro. And then this is also something interesting. So we went back to this very old paper from Pasco Rakish from 1976. And so he did do some reconstruction from fetal human cerebellum. And so we see that the type of morphology we see is very consistent with the morphology of Purkinje neurons in vivo. However, what we don't see, so this is in, you know, 6 month old organoids. However, we haven't published this, but I can say that when, you know, at terms, we know that the Purkinje neurons have these beautiful huge dendrites. We all know these beautiful cells, but we don't see that. So in vitro, somehow, again, there is something missing. And for some reason, while until the organoids are 6 months old, they really resemble morphologically what we see in vivo. Later, after that, there is something that, you know, limits the really the growth, at least from a morphological point of view, of these Purkinje neurons. So our dream is to try to find ways to being able to instead, you know, push the maturation of these Purkinje neurons. And so this is, I have to say also now we are using this protocol to model neurodevelopmental, neuropsychiatric disorders. And so we are doing some work on understanding the function of SYNGAP1 also in cerebellar development, since some of these patients, about 40% of SYNGAP patients, they have also cerebellar ataxia. So we are interested in looking at that. And and this is my last slide and summary of this last part of my work. So today I show you that we have been able to generate reproducible long-term culture of functional human cerebellar organoids. A generation, we have been able to generate bona fide functional Purkinje neurons in an all-human system. So before, to see mature Purkinje cells, basically this culture really needed co-culture with mouse granule and mouse glial cells. And so this is the first protocol that allows development of functional Purkinje cells in an all human system. And then this obviously has implication for modeling several disorders, including medulloblastoma, degenerative disorders like ataxia, and as I said, we are interested in understanding also how they can contribute, what's the contribution of genes associated to neuropsychiatric disorder to cerebellar development. And with this, I really like to thank all my lab members that did all the work. In particular, I would like to thank Marcella Birchel, and then Ashley for the work on SYNGAP1, Alex Atamian for developing the cerebellar organoid protocols, Giorgio Nguyen that you see with this weird orange suit here in and he's a bioinformatician in the lab. And then our collaborators, funding agency, and thank you for listening.
Hi, very nice talk, especially like at the end where you talked about having both inhibitory and excitatory neurons in there, because I think that most people have been looking at excitatory neurons, focusing more on excitatory neurons than inhibitory. But these organoids are non-vascularized, and so the cores become necrotic, right? And so I'm wondering about your thoughts on that, especially you looked at this mRNA Explorer that you're looking at using. And with the mRNA Explorer, my concern is that you get the mRNA that is coming from the healthy cells, but you're also getting the mRNA that's coming from the necrotic cells. And how do you look at that and the ability to be able to differentiate what's actually relevant from the healthy cells versus the necrotic cells?
Yeah, thank you. This is a really great question. I must say, of course, you know, we have this necrotic center in organoids. In cerebellar organoids, because they are smaller, it's much smaller than what we see in cortical organoids, but it's still there. So for sure, you know, we need to, as a field, to develop a system to vascularize these organoids and to really create cells that are functional, And there are many people actually putting effort into that. So I'm hopeful that, you know, soon we'll see some progress into this. And in terms of the RNA Explorer, yes, you're totally right. We are at very early stages of this project, but so at the moment we are really still testing the RNA Explorer in 2D cultures, and then there are other issues also. You know, we don't know if some of this RNA will be trapped inside, you know, this 3D organoid. So it is something that, you know, we are considering. I think in general, you know, assuming these RNAs can, you know, travel outside the organoids, we, at the very least, you know, we can get the pictures about the cell type composition. So even if we do have, like, you know, cells that are less healthy, we can, you know, at least understand which cell types are there. I think this, you know, can be coupled anytime with single cell sequencing, which of course is a destructive method, right? But I think we have a lot of background work to do in, you know, establishing the technique and validating it and see what, you know, how we can improve it. But yeah, these are very good points. Thank you.
Thank you. I've actually got a second question. And that is that one of the other things that is underrepresented that I've seen in the field is counting and delineating the different types of synapses, right? Because when it comes to neuronal connections, it's really the synapses that matter. So have you guys gone in and looked at not only counting the number of synapses, but the types of synapses, whether they are inhibitory and excitatory, and what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, definitely. We haven't done that. We have done only, you know, some pharmacology, you know, in general, and then look at the changes in activity, and that's all we have done. But I agree, there is a lot of work to do in that sense, and not many, laboratories in the field are really, I think, expert in electrophysiology somehow and functional work. And so there is, I think, a big gap to, you know, to really try to, we need to do more work on that. We haven't done it, but it's, a great comment. Thank you.
Great, thank you.
Yeah, thank you for your talk and making the drive down. A couple slides ago, you were talking about the cerebellar organoids, and I think you were showing live calcium imaging from that, and you showed a time-dependent increase in coordination from these neurons, and you pointed towards that effect being due to the inhibitory neurons. And I'm wondering, how do you know that you have inhibitory neurons in that culture?
Mm-hmm. What we have done is just to do some pharmacology, and we have, you know, shown that there is there is a contribution both of inhibitory and excitatory neurons. At some point I show some data showing that we have done some optogenetic stimulation of basically we have inhibited Purkinje neuron specifically, because we had a virus that is specifically, the optogenetic machinery is specifically under control of Purkinje neurons. So we know we are inhibiting the Purkinje neurons, and then we see increase in the activity. But yeah, we do not have done a very thorough characterization work of the type of interneurons, and we just know there is contribution of both excitatory and inhibitory neurons, and the Purkinje neurons specifically are functional. There is more work to do for sure.
Hi, Georgia, great presentation. I had a question about your protocol that you're using to generate the cerebellum organoids. Is it very different from the protocol that Sasai used a couple of years ago?
Yeah. So it's very different, yes. So, the patterning strategy is completely different. So Sasai's protocol basically uses only short parts of FGF2 to catalyze the organoids. Instead, we use WNT and then FGF8 to specify the ismic organizer. Also, the base media is different. And then we have, for long-term culture, Sasai only, I think, developed these organoids up to 2 months. And then he was co-culturing them with mouse granule cells and glia, I think. So, so we have also this media for, long-term maintenance of organoids. So it is a very different, to start with, very different patterning strategy.
Mm-hmm. Are you considering doing a similar strategy that he did to get Purkinje cells with more complex cerebralization? Because I think the only strategy that exists to date is co-culturing with mouse granule cells to get Purkinje cells with a robust enough cerebralization. And I think even with your strategy, you cannot reach that point.
So thank you for that. So the Purkinje cells we generate in vivo, as I said, they really are very, from a transcriptional point of view, they really express all the markers that, identify Purkinje cells. And then functionally, most importantly, we see that their firing profile is the same that we see in vivo. So I think, they, these organs are 6 months old, these cells are really perfect replicate of, what we see in vivo. After that point, I'm not sure, if the work I know of, I have never seen, even through co-culture with mouse and glial cells, I have not seen better data, to be honest, of what we see functionally. It could be, I have not done it myself, but I don't know. To me, anyway, it's, it's very important to have an all-human system if we want to study disorders like, for example, ataxia. We know that several subtype of ataxia cannot be remodeled in mouse, modeling mouse. So we know that, and then for neuropsychiatric disorders, having, human cells and contribution, we know that the importance of genetic background for these disorders. So for personally, we are interested, in trying to develop this system in still using just all human cell types. And then our, interest is really also trying to increase the level of activity input to try to mature these cells more. So we're going to go with that, I think. Thank you.
My last question was about your SYNGAP1 work. When you were looking at the division angle of the radial glial cells, and you assume it's more towards a differentiation division, causing accelerated maturation. Since this protein is involved in the apical domain of the rosettes, do you think there could be some delamination of the progenitors instead of just only shifting from an early symmetric to a symmetric division?
Yes. This is something, definitely, it's a possibility. So we haven't really look at that, but we have always thought, that this could be a possibility. These patients have also showed these enlarged ventricles, so for sure there is a weakening of the wall. And we haven't really done that work of really looking at details about the damage, but certainly is a possibility. I think there is definitely a problem in migration, and then there are multiple, I think, issues. When you alter the scaffolding, as I said, basal, and then the apical process is very important for the maintenance of the ventricle integrity. So I think these are all possibilities. Then a different question is what happens in the patient, because what we know is that definitely some of these these phenotypes are compensated in the patient. And this is something that I think there is lots of problem, because also the phenotype of this patient, even just affluence in which we have, in which SYNGAP1, patient in which SYNGAP1 is affluence sufficient, is very heterogeneous, super. So there are definitely some compensatory effect in vivo. And what I think, you know, we'll discover once we are able to look at tissue from the brain of this patient, which we do not have available at the moment, is that probably there is a problem in layering, in the layering of these neurons. This is my bet. But yeah, and I don't know if, you know, in vivo we will see also delamination or something like that. But yeah, these are all possibilities. Thank you for the comment.
Thank you.
Thanks for the great talk. This side, I'm John Collins.
Sorry, I'm not wearing my glasses also.
Okay, sorry. Yeah, I've seen you mentioned the microfluidics addition to these organoids. Is it for oxygen transport into the organoid core, or is it more for differentiation and more biomarkers? How about vascularized organoids? Does it require more fluidics to get better biomarkers representation?
Yeah, so now we are in the process of doing a bit more of a, you know, thorough characterization of these organoids and see what happens. So we're doing some single cell sequencing and try to understand. I really think that, you know, in addition to increased oxygenation, I think there is probably a component. We know that, you know, this in our brain, there is a certain type of flow, and there are, you know, receptors that are very sensitive to flow. And and so I think, you know, it's probably overall this type of condition are more physiological, but the short answer is that we don't know exactly, you know, what is happening, why they are so much healthier, beside, you know, the improvement in oxygenation.
Thank you.
So there are questions from the Zoom audience. Do you think that eventually microglial cells can be included in organoids to study synaptic pruning?
Yeah, so this is a great question. This has been done by several groups in cortical organoids. There is, you know, microglia has been integrated, and I think that's very important. We are doing this currently for cerebellar organoids as well. So yeah, definitely very important.
And the second question that I have, amazing talk. Have you tried to cryopreserve these organoids and then culture them again? If so, are all the populations surviving the freeze-thaw process?
Yeah, we have been trying to do that, but we haven't been successful. So I think maybe very early stages organoids can be cryoprotected. Later stages organoids, I really don't think so. But we haven't even been able to be successful with early stages. I know other laboratories have done that, though. So, yeah.
Okay, thank you. Let's thank Georgia again for a fantastic talk today.